region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunlap.
Hello, and I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Today we start off with Mark's coverage of a press conference next week.
Last week,
about how New York State could power the state capital complex with 100% renewable energy.
Then we have a repeat performance from climate journalist Dar Jamal, who spoke here at the Sanctuary a couple weeks ago, and he is going to be speaking at the Qatari press conference, I think August 17th.
And afterwards, we have a weekly food diary segment from Amy Holleran. Then a segment from Willie Terry on the issue of parole.
And we finish up with a piece on an Apollo 11 celebration, actually I believe in Schenectady at the observatory out there. But first, news headlines.
Governor Cuomo on Thursday is expected to sign a New York's climate legislation that seeks to largely eliminate carbon emissions over the next 30 years. While some climate activists believe that timetable is too slow to avoid climate chaos, others doubt that the state will meet the limited goals that is established, such as getting 70% of its electricity from renewables by 2030. Is that right? 2030.
Right.
The state's climate plan is not due yet for another 4 years.
A divided House voted to condemn President Trump's racist remarks, telling four minority congresswomen to go back to their ancestral countries, with all but a handful of Republicans dismissing the rebuke as harassment. It is expected that the House may actually take up a vote on impeachment on Wednesday.
And John Paul Stevens, whose 35 years on the U.S. Supreme Court transformed him from a Republican antitrust lawyer into an outspoken leader of the court's liberal wing. Well, he died on Tuesday at the age of 99.
The Time Union reports that embattled co-host Mayor Sean Morris has been accused of defamation in a lawsuit filed by a city resident who was a target of a series of incendiary statements that the mayor made on a local talk radio show in January 2018. The resident was a friend of the mayor's wife and it had been encouraging her to leave the mayor over allegations of domestic violence. Morris, who was recently defeated in the Democratic Party mayoral primary, goes on trial in September on federal criminal charges of lying to FBI agents and stealing campaign funds for personal use.
On the fifth anniversary of the police killing of Eric Gardner on Staten Island, federal prosecutors announced that they won't bring criminal charges against the white New York City police officer who, in a chokehold death of the black man whose dying words, "I can't breathe," became national rallying cry against the police brutality. Officer Daniel Penatello remains on the city's police force.
New York will raise the smoking age from 18 to 21 under legislation signed into law Tuesday by Governor Cuomo. The change, which takes effect in 120 days, will apply to the sales of traditional tobacco products as well as electronic cigarettes and vaporizers.
And in the first successful case of its kind, a judge in The Hague has ruled that Dutch government stance on climate change is illegal and has ordered them to take action to cut greenhouse gas emissions by a hefty 25% within 5 years. Well, that's it for the news headlines tonight.
So the science team of SHARE, which is the Sheridan Hollow Alliance for Renewable Energy, has submitted a report to Governor Cuomo showing that the state could power the Empire State Plaza and state capitol with 100% clean renewable energy rather than the frack gas turbines that the governor and staff had proposed. We hear from Mert Simpson, Keith Hsu, and David Musser. We're talking with Mert Simpson, who's co-chair of SHARE, the group that's been working to stop having a frack gas plant at Sheridan Avenue and move towards a more renewable energy system to heat the Empire State Plaza and the state capitol. And they presented a report from a scientific committee today. Mert, what was the summary point you were making with the study?
That since August of 2017, we've done diligent research into alternatives to fossil fuels. And what we've discovered is that it's more than feasible to do something with things like alternative load sharing, geothermal energy, and, you know, supplemented by solar, hydro and other things from the macro grid. But when we first started, New York State government said they had looked at all the alternatives and found them to be wanting. When we did a Freedom of Information request and asked them for what the data was that led them to that conclusion, they came back saying that we have no information responsive to this request. So basically, they were just bluffing. With climate change on the presidential agenda, we think that it's an opportunity for us to put a spotlight on the need for saving our planet. You know, the global scientists have said we've got a 12-year window before the Earth becomes, you know, unlivable, and we have to think about our grandchildren. We're a little concerned that we've had continual dialogue with the New York Power Authority, OGS, and NYSERDA, and we feel that they should be moving much more expeditiously based on us as non-professionals being able to discover what we have that actually exists, which is transferable to here, and the fact that the experts in the government are kind of languishing and not moving expeditiously. So our plea now, based on the documentation that we're presenting in this report, is that do the right thing.
Now, in this year's state budget, the legislature and the governor agreed that this facility should, in fact, be done with 100% renewable energy to the extent that that's practical. What has sort of NYPA's response, New York Power Authority response, been to this direction provided in the state budget?
Well, we really haven't had any robust feedback from them. Actually, we're requesting an audience with them. We know that they've met with other community groups, they've met with us in the past, but we haven't met with them in over a year to discuss this, and so we're a little bit concerned about that. I mean, again, we've been able to stop them from the initial proposal that they wanted to have online by probably the middle of 2018, but just not going forward is not good enough. What we need to do is use those dollars to initiate a process to make New York State a model for sustainability for the whole nation.
Now, you're a county legislator who represents the Sheridan Avenue, Arbor Hill area.
Yes.
What are some of the concerns about pollution or other impacts that local residents and yourself have about this facility?
Well, there's a really disturbing history about people who live very close to the plant having disproportionate statistical incidence of cancer. You know, my own sister-in-law died from multiple myeloma, which we, you know, have a strong reason to believe was directly initiated by access to the toxins that came out of the plant that's been running since 1911. But the number of families with, you know, terminal cancer in proximity to that plant is statistically off the scale. And of course, you know, when you come to litigation, there's always an argument about whether the evidence you see is really, you know, viable. Like, it's mysterious to us that the governor, as astute that we know he is, why he doesn't understand, just from a pure economic point of view, that green energy is the energy of the future. You know, Donald Trump talks about restoring the coal industry. That's a pipe dream. That's not going to happen. But for New York State, the Empire State Plaza, to have its capital fuel with archaic, you know, fossil fuels, is just not acceptable in the 21st century.
Now, one of the issues that has come up is that right now and in the future, they have a backup generator system in case of emergencies. Do you want that to be replaced? Do you want the state to move on that now? What's the issue with the backup generator issue?
Well, they need to get rid of the backup generators because they're obsolete, they're archaic, and actually they don't need to be located where they are. But in terms of this new project, we don't mind them having backup generators because the probability is strong that they'll never be used. I mean, there are generators in Manhattan in St. Patrick's Cathedral that they've never had to use because of the efficiency of geothermal. So we think just the robustness of the energy grid in Albany, we really would probably never have to use use those. But if, as a negotiating, you know, principle, we say they can have some updated generators, and preferably not in that location, we seat them that as long as they move in the right direction, with the knowledge that the probability of them actually being used would be minimal.
Thank you, Mert Simpson. Next, we talk with Keith Hsu, who is one of the co-chairs of the Sheer Science Committee and one of the authors, along with Dave Musser, of this report. Keith, what were some of the key points in this report you're giving to the governor's people?
Well, I think our report does a good job of identifying the outstanding opportunities that there are for renewables, both for electricity as well as for geothermal technology. One of the things that we do is we take a close look at what NYPA has proposed, which is their CHP proposal.
CHP is combined heat and power?
Combined heat and power. Basically, it means you're burning fossil fuels for electricity and you're burning fossil fuels for heat. And there was a time in the past where that might have been an efficiency improvement. That's not the case anymore today. Today we have technology that can dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We can get off of fossil fuels for heating. We don't need to do combustion heating anymore. The plant that exists today is using combustion heat for both heating the Empire State Plaza as well as for running centrifugal chillers to create cooling, which means that you have combustion heating going on throughout the year in Sheridan Hollow. You don't need to do it that way. With modern geothermal technology, you can use, whether it's a ground source or river source, heat sink and heat source, you can use geothermal technology to solve this problem without combustion.
And I understand that because this is a steam facility, it actually, for more than a century, has already been taking water out of the Hudson River. So this is not really a new use of the Hudson River water. It's a different use. That's what you're proposing.
That's correct. I mean, there actually are pipes already that bring water in from the Hudson. That water is used as part of the condensing of the cycle for the steam. It's also used as a heat sink for their air conditioning plant, their central air conditioning plant. What we're proposing is to pull out those very ancient centrifugal chillers that are operated by steam, which turns the compressors within those chillers, to pull that stuff out and to replace it with modern heat pump, which basically can use the river or ground source wells for either for heat extraction or heat transfer. Basically, we can create heat for the Empire State Plaza or cooling for the Empire State Plaza with modern geothermal.
Now we have 90 seconds left. One of the other issues in terms of electricity, the state apparently has been saying, oh, well, we can't put enough solar panels on roofs in downtown Albany to really meet the needs we're trying to do. What's been Sheer's response to that?
Well, no kidding. I mean, we've known all along that you're going to be limited if you're just putting your solar panels in the downtown area. It's an urban area. You can't squeeze enough solar powers to run the Empire State Plaza with solar downtown. But that's, you don't need to. The thing is, if you have a robust macro grid and you stay connected to that robust macro grid, then you have lots of room in the surrounding area around Albany and elsewhere to bring in electricity from renewables, whether it's hydropower or large-scale solar farms or wind farms, to power the plaza with renewables. And what that means is then, in terms of the microgrid, is like Mert was saying, is that for normal operations, 99.99999% of the time, you're going to be in a situation where you have the electricity you need from renewable sources that are on the outside grid. In the rare times when the outside grid goes down and you have to rely on a local generation, then that's maybe where your backup diesels kick in.
But so if people want to get a copy of this report, Dave, how can they do so?
Look on sharealbany.org. It will be posted there later today.
Thank you very much, Keith Hsu, Dave Musser, and Mert Simpson. This is Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And we'll keep you updated on the progress in trying to green the power needs of the state capital. Okay, for this week's peace segment, we talked with Dahar Jamal, author of The End Device on Climate Change. Dahar will be a keynote speaker on climate change at the Katrin Peace Conference on August 17th.
We're joined now by Dar Jamal, who's been on our radio show a number of times and has spoken here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. He's going to be one of the featured speakers at the 2019 Qatari Peace Conference, which is going to take place on Friday, August 16th, and Saturday, August 17th. This year, a lot will be focused on the issue of defying extinction, nurturing a garden of resilience in the face of climate crisis. We had Dar come in to the sanctuary to talk about his new book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness, and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Destruction. So, Dar, welcome back to WOOC.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Great to be with you again.
Now, unfortunately, the news on the climate front does not appear to be going well. You, of course, your book was very concerned about the issue of loss of ice, and unfortunately, it seems like the Arctic and Antarctica is still melting faster than we had anticipated.
It is. That's really one of the most disconcerting aspects of the climate crisis from my perspective, given the importance of these ecosystems remaining intact. And certainly the ice, I mean, the obvious ramifications with sea level rise. We have the Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica. That's one of the more recent reports to come out showing how fast things are going, that part of the Antarctic coming unplugged essentially could translate to 20 inches of sea level rise just by itself. Meanwhile, up in the Arctic, we have record high temperatures across the region. Anchorage, Alaska, for example, broke, hit 90 degrees for the first time in history for that day, shattering the old record by 5 degrees. And that's not technically in the Arctic, but as we move just a little further north from that up into the Arctic, we have permafrost thawing at unprecedented rates. Some of the scientists I interviewed for my book were talking about thawing at the levels we're seeing right now this year, that probably they didn't expect it to happen until the 2050s or 2070s, and it's already happening now. So it gives you an idea of just the rapidity and the acceleration of the crisis that's unfolding right now.
Now, unfortunately, we still have this guy, Donald Trump, in charge of the White House, and obviously not good news in terms of climate action, but how are some of the other countries in Europe, Japan, China, have they been stepping up their game, particularly as we get more of these dire reports about how fast things are actually occurring?
Well, certainly relative to the U.S. I mean, it's almost funny that we even have to mention that because, you know, a five-year-old child could do a better job dealing with the climate crisis than the Trump administration. So, comparatively, certainly, Europe, for example, we have countries that are setting much more quick deadlines as far as making certain cities like Paris, okay, no more gas-powered cars allowed inside the city limits, and certainly knocking down their emissions much, much more quickly than the U.S. But even those, I should add, I think are kind of laughable reactions compared to the gravity of the crisis that we're in. We have all the science. We know what's upon us. We know that it looks like even cutting all CO2 emissions on a dime today means we're probably looking at 3C increase in temperatures already baked into the system. And that is absolutely beyond catastrophic climate disruption. So, you know, while phasing out fuel cars in inner cities and setting carbon reduction limits down to levels by 2030, 2040, this kind of thing, I think it's still a weak response compared to the immediate crisis dramatic action that really ought to be happening to do whatever we can today to try to mitigate, to buy a little bit of time so that we can enable ourselves to adapt onto this new planet that we've created for ourselves.
Obviously, I don't expect you to be an expert on New York. You're more of a national, international figure. Though New York likes to proclaim it just passed the strongest climate legislation in the country, it at least has climate goals for renewable energy that are among the strongest in the country, 70% of electricity coming from renewable electricity by 2030 is the new goal. But one thing they refused to do was to actually call for an immediate halt or any type of halt to fossil fuel projects. And that seems to be a concern. I mean, you can increase renewable energy, but if you're not actually stopping fossil fuels, are you really solving the problem?
Right. It is a bit of rearranging the deck chairs, similar to the Green New Deal, which is essentially capitalism with a green leaf on it. I mean, you know, I just read the proposal put forth of the declaration, not necessarily the new Green Deal, but declaring the climate emergency by AOC and Bernie Sanders. And even in there, it's they work in some of the Green New Deal of, you know, this is going to create so many jobs and it's going to actually help to grow the economy and this kind of thing. And it's really similar to what you just said, where, you know, on the one hand, at least it's a step in the right general direction. It's certainly better than nothing. I don't want to be completely disparaging of it. But again, looking at the scope of the crisis that we are in, it really is kind of laughable and a waste of time compared to the really overt, dramatic actions that need to be happening right now. For example, in New York City, why are they still talking about seawalls and construction right along the coast? I mean, there's, you know, factoring in 20 to 30 foot of sea level rise and probably realistically within the next 150 to 200 years at a maximum, if not sooner than that. Why are they even talking about that? It's a really different shift in consciousness of getting our heads around the gravity of the crisis. Then we're able to respond accordingly.
Just to give a little defense of the Green New Deal, you probably read in the Democratic version, but an old friend of mine who's running actually for president as a Green Party candidate is an eco-socialist. He has a much more radical version of the Green New Deal. He started to promote that when he ran for governor and did quite well back here in New York in 2010. And, you know, of course, AOC has done a good job, but 8 years later in a much more moderate position. So at the Kateri press conference, what's going to be sort of your message and why should people come and hear you speak at this?
Well, there's going to be a real strong focus on the indigenous perspective of what's happening. And I actually consider myself in that context sort of a sub-speaker to at least two that I know of, if not more than that, but two other indigenous speakers that will be speaking very eloquently and articulately about the need for us to really ground back into the earth. And that's essentially the theme that I'm going to be talking about. It's what I came to in the conclusion of my book, where if in order for each of us to have the personal resiliency that's going to be required from these times that we're in and going forward, each one of us needs to really ground down into the earth and listen really, really closely. And because each one of us, if we do that, I believe is going to get a very individualized and specific message about what is our work to do. And so instead of, you know, some activist telling us what to do or some political leader, I think it's really more in line as a time to not be frenetic and running around hurried, but stop, pause, and really sink down into the earth and listen. And it's in that way we're going to get the intelligence that we need in order to how we're going to adapt and live in these times, because things are only going to continue to intensify. And so I think that indigenous message coming from people who have essentially already lived through their own apocalypse. I mean, this the great government of this country almost completely annihilated the indigenous population and the genocide upon which this country is built. So if these people can survive that and they're still here, I think we need to listen to them about how to be during these times.
And, you know, I know when you came and spoke at the sanctuary, you talked about, you know, how one deals with grief, and even if one, you know, is convinced that we're too late to really to stop climate change, it's still important as to how we take actions. It really reflects on our values and our vision of a future, even though the odds may be stacked against us. I know you write a lot for your Truth Out, author of The End of Ice, Spear and Witness, and Fine and Mean in the Path of Climate Disruption from the New Press. If people want to keep track of what you're up to, Dora, how best can they do that?
Well, as you just mentioned, in addition to my own website where I archive every article I write, whether it's for Truth Out or elsewhere, and that's myname.net. It's DAHRJAMAIL.net.
Well, thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. And that, of course, was Dar Jamal. We've interviewed Dar previously, and so you can find some of his interviews on our podcast page, Sanctuary Independent Media. And we'll be bringing you more interviews on the Qatari Peace Conference, which will be taking place on August 16th and 17th at the Qatari Shrine out there in Fonda. For those of you just tuning in, and even if you've been listening for a while, I'm Mark Dunley.
Hi, and I'm Andrea Cunliffe. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine and the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC at 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And now, HMM correspondent Amy Holleran talks about the summer meal gap for kids.
Hi, I'm Amy Halloran with another Food Diary. Today, I have Natasha Pernica of the Food Pantries for the Capital District joining me to talk about summer food needs. Hi, Natasha.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Amy.
Oh, thanks for talking about our favorite topic, food, not summer food, but thanks for joining. There's so much room for people learning about the food needs in and around the Capital District. And so I thought of the food pantries because of your special produce program. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I'll talk about the mobile produce sites that we host. And wanted to mention that one of the big things that we're trying to do beyond supporting our member food pantries is by helping to fill the gap, helping to provide an increase to access and resources throughout the capital region. And so one of the things we recognized is that when the kids are not in school, so a lot of kids rely on breakfast and lunch through their school programs, they have an opportunity to get meals from the summer meal sites. One of the things that we wanted to do was use that opportunity to provide more food for the entire family and make sure that the families knew about the resources, the additional resources in the community to help them supplement their food in the summertime. So a lot of families actually seek food assistance from food pantries, but we wanted to make sure that everyone knew food pantries were available. So this led us to what we call our Food Connect mobile food outreach program. And it's a free produce stand. And we partner with some of the summer meal programs for their lunchtime visit. And the children get free lunch from the summer meal site, and the parents and children can go to the produce stand and pick out as much free produce as they'll be able to use and take it home with them. And at the same time, we provide basic needs resource information and other connection to services. So the program has really grown over the past 3 years, and we're really excited that we're able to connect with so many people.
It's such a good idea. People really need more fresh fruits and vegetables. We're certainly told this in a million different ways by the government, by nutritionists. But the real problem is access, and you are bridging that access. You're creating a bridge right to the food for free that is so much more expensive for anyone than other foods.
Yeah.
So it's critical, right? And so what does it look like at one of these sites? Can you describe what produce is out there and how people are responding to it?
Sure. So we just set up like a 10 by 10 tent. It kind of looks like a farmer's market stand. And the produce that we have available depends on the free produce that's available at the food bank that morning. So it's fresh from the food bank. There can be berries, greens, zucchini, lettuce, apples, potatoes, onions. I mean, it could be all kinds of things that people easily recognize and are like, oh, yes. one summer we had a boy and his little sister come up to the stand, and we had all of these fresh berries, and their eyes just got so big, and they were so excited, and they said, can we take even more? Our grandma loves berries, and she's going to be so excited. And we're like, sure, like, take as much as you'll need. Other times we have things like arugula that people are not, you know, children in particular, maybe are not quite as familiar with. And there was a boy that came up to the stand, and we said, have you ever had arugula before? And he said, no. And we said, well, you want to try some? And he was like, sure. And so we let him try a little bit, and he took a bag home. So it's really fun to give the opportunity to expose different kinds of things that people might not have access to on a regular basis, and then also the things that are their favorites as well. So it's been really great. People really appreciate that we're there so that they can take the produce home for their entire family.
It's really a dream program to me. I know that I have a hard time affording enough fresh fruits and vegetables. So imagine if you're income constrained and time constrained, working two jobs. How are you going to get all those fresh fruits and vegetables that your body needs and your kids need? Where did you guys come up with the idea for this project? And how? And was it difficult getting funding to try to make it happen?
Sure. Well, we originally came up with the idea through our Filling the Gap food pantry system and community needs assessment, where there's more than 80,000 people considered food insecure in our region, and about 50,000 people visit food pantries. So we wanted to try to fill the gap and make sure that everyone was aware. And the other piece was that we wanted to make sure that people had access to food. So our original idea was to actually have a mobile food pantry. And as we got started on the logistics, we recognized that the produce would be great because we can always get more produce out. The thing that's great about the program is that whatever program doesn't go at the summer meal site, we partner with our member food pantries and take it directly to the pantry where it goes out immediately to the people visiting the food pantry. So it's not only getting more produce out at the summer meal sites, but it's also getting more produce to the individual food pantries as well. And as far as support, you know, we can provide as many of these sites as we have funding to support. And a lot of people are really excited about this. So as I said, we've been growing the program. Our first year, we just had one site. Last year, we had several sites. And this year, we're running 5 days a week this summer, and we'll be expanding into throughout the year this fall. So we're very excited. And if people in the community have a site that they feel like would be a good fit to provide more produce as well as connect people to resources in the community, and they are able to help support it, we would love to partner.
So you're saying that you're thinking of expanding beyond the summer meal programs to other community sites that would be well served by this kind of thing?
Yeah, we are. We have some schools that are interested in hosting sites throughout the year, and some other organizations like senior centers. Mm-hmm. So we are, if someone has a site that they know people are struggling with getting access to food and other resources, it's a great opportunity. And we're happy to talk to people.
Now, people can donate directly to food pantries. Is that correct, Natasha?
Yes, that's right. There's 67 food pantries in our coalition doing amazing work, like Unity House's food pantry that you're involved with, Amy. And pantries can always use food to distribute out to the community. And a lot of this is a great time in the summer to help restock pantry shelves. A lot of people think of food drives. They're donating produce from their garden. And also, we always want people to keep in mind that dollars can go farther. If you want to donate dollars directly to food pantries, a lot of times they can make that dollar go a lot farther than if you go to the grocery store and buy food to donate. So just keep that in mind if you want to get involved and make a difference right here for your neighbors.
That's great advice. Natasha Pernicka from the Food Pantries for the Capital District, thank you so much for talking with us about summer food.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Amy. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. This has been Amy Halloran with another Food Diary.
So if the zucchini is overrunning your back garden, think about donating that extra produce to a local food pantry. But that was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Amy Halloran talking with the food pantries for the Capital District with another Food Diary. Up next, the irascible Willie Terry, the Roman labor correspondent for WOOC, attended the Albany Region Community Conversation on the problems people on parole are dealing with locally across the region. The meeting took place on May 21st at the Albany, at the Arbor Hill Public Library. In this segment, we'll hear from Melanie Trimble of the Albany Civil Liberties Union and Cedric Fulton of the Catal. Well, he's a community organizer for Catal, which was the sponsor of the event.
Good evening. May I have your attention, please? Welcome to the Albany Region Community Conversation. This is just Catal's contribution to the community. We encourage everyone to speak. However, we ask that you just keep it classy. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Cedric Fulton.
I definitely don't need no applause. I'm not really doing any work. You know, I'm looking around this room and I see some people here doing some really, really good work in Albany and the Capital District. And I want, those are the people that really need to get applauded. They don't get a lot of opportunities for us to recognize the work that they do, looking around. Definitely want to recognize those folks in the room that's doing some really great work. A lot of times we get in these positions, especially as a black man, we get in these positions and we use our positions just to further ourselves. I need to take this opportunity to look out and say, these are some people that's doing some great work, and how can I elevate their work and get more eyes on their work and join their work? Too many times we work in silos, and if we come together and work the way we're supposed to work, we'll get some great things happen. It'll be a long process, but it's a process in and of itself. So I just wanted to say that right off the bat. Again, like Ron said, this is a community conversation. This is Catal's contribution. We sure that there's been many community conversations, and there will be many more. We encourage that there'll be many more. And not just community conversations led by organizers, but just from people that live in this community. They say, listen, man, we got something to say. Can you give us the space? And we put that together that we can elevate their leadership so they can advocate for themselves and advocate for their communities. There's some great leaders here. Sometimes we look in the churches for leaders. Sometimes we look in schools for leaders. We look in all these traditional places for leaders. There's leaders in the soup kitchen. There's leaders in the drop-in center. There's leaders on at Camino Nuevo. There's leaders all over this place. There's leaders in Troy. What we need to do is we need to recognize these leaders, give them the resources that they need to succeed, and then get out of the way and let them do their thing. So many times people ask the organizer, hey, can we interview you? Can you talk in front of the microphone? Can you do this? And it's like, no, we got some great people that can do that work. We got some experts here that can talk. There's some experts right here that can talk about the issues that's going on in the Capital District. Let them talk. We in a time right now where we had some pretty historic criminal justice reform bills that just passed in our 2020 fiscal year budget. Yeah, definitely. That definitely needs to be applauded. Now, is there work? Is there more work needed to be done? Absolutely, there's more work needed to be done. However, where we are right now, where we landed, I think we're in a great spot. The criminal justice reform bills affects 90% of the people in the state of New York, 90% of the population. 90% of the people in the state of New York get arrested for misdemeanors or nonviolent felonies. That's what they get arrested for. The criminal justice reform bills that just was passed, especially particularly the bail bill, affects those folks, right? We have the discovery bill is the gem of the criminal justice reform bills. So I want to take the opportunity before I get into parole justice, parole reform, very, very quickly, because this is... With that, I'm asking Melanie Trimble to come up, just briefly talk about the criminal justice reform bills. Melanie is from the New York Civil Liberties Union.
So we had some really, some great success, particularly in the discovery bill. It's going to be one of the best in the country. You used to have to wait maybe 60 days, 90 days, or your lawyer had to beg, borrow, and, you know, practically steal information from the district attorneys in the area just to know what evidence they had against you. Often people were pleading out to deals without ever seeing anything because they were told by the district attorneys, if you don't plead out, we're going to really sock it to you and you'll be in jail for a long, long time. So this is much more fair. It's righting the system as far as the district attorneys go. And we're hoping to see great success in how it's implemented. Of course, we'll always be watching. The bail reform was very important because it eliminates cash bail for low-level, nonviolent misdemeanor offenses. It doesn't go far enough, and that's one thing that we will continue to work on in the next year. One good thing was that the insiders stopped them from including a dangerousness clause, because we all know that district attorneys will overcharge just to be able to put you in jail. And containing a dangerous clause causes a lot of problems in how judges interpret it, how dangerous the offenses are, and so on. So that one we really have to work on in the fall. However, because we're eliminating cash bail, it's going to be a tremendous change, particularly with age, the change in the age. You know, finally, we're not going to be putting 16 and 17-year-old kids in jail and in prison. Another thing is speedy trial. We couldn't really get speedy trial without a good discovery bill. But speedy trial's at issue because you can languish sitting in jail. The advocates were not as concerned to not get speedy trial, only because now we don't have people, hopefully will not have people languishing in jail for long periods of time, just waiting to get to trial. But that's going to be fixed as well.
Thank you, Melanie. And if you look at it, we look at the optics. If we're going to be real, we look at the optics. We know who's getting arrested at alarming rates. We know who's filling up these jails at alarming rates. We get folks, we got pets also. People don't talk about these pets. We got pets also. I got a pet that if something happens to my pet, my children will go crazy. It's a part of my family. You know, you get locked up for even 3 days. They putting your pet down and things like that. People getting locked up for 7 days and things like that. People getting locked up for a month, and certain folks say, oh, it's nothing, it's only a month. No, that's a life changer. Not only that, it changes the whole trajectory of somebody's quality of life. You know, so, you know, I'm preaching to the choir when we're talking about criminal justice reform. But at the same time, we look at the criminal justice system and we blame the criminal justice system and we let the safety nets off the hook. So we got to hold the safety net accountable also. We got to hold the Department of Social Services accountable. We got to hold our education system accountable. We got to hold our healthcare system accountable. We got to hold everybody accountable. You go in, you know, Niskayuna, and then you got Arbor Hill. You got two school nurses in these places, right? You get the same policies, the same, you know, the same principles. However, what's a mental health crisis in Niskayuna turns into a criminal justice offense in Arbor Hill. So those are things that we need to look at. This is how it affects it. We're talking about less is more New York. We're talking about parole justice. We're talking about people that's getting violated, going back to jail for technical violations. They did their time already. They got sentenced, did their time. They came home, and they're getting returned back to prison because of missing a curfew, smoking some weed, drinking some alcohol, hanging out with a known felon. Those things, right, those are not crimes in and of itself. However, what they do is, I'm a single father of a 9 and a 10-year-old. If you just seen, my son just walked up to me spontaneously and gave me a kiss on the cheek. And, you know, it's just like, I'm the first person he sees in the morning, the last person he sees at night. I end up getting locked up for a technical violation if I was on parole, and that happens 2 or 3 times, that trust is gone. That trust just got thrown out the door. You know, those family members that rely on me, that I might be coaching a little league team or whatever the situation is. And then a lot of times we also forget about women. We always talking about men being system involved and we forget about these women. Women need justice also, you know, so we need to fight for our women also across race lines and across economic lines also. But we also know who's the marginalized. So let me give you a quick background on parole, technical violations, less is more. And Less is More New York was written in January of 2018 by a gentleman named Vinny Schiraldi. Vinny Schiraldi is a former probation commissioner. He was the probation commissioner for the biggest probation department in New York City, that means in New York State, all right, by default. So Vinny, along with four other commissioners, former commissioners, got together and they wanted to address community supervision. They wanted to address the overpopulations of our jails and our prisons. Community supervision was first designed to decarcerate jails. Right now, it's the biggest driver of mass incarceration. That's the only stat in New York State jails and prisons that's been on the rise since 2012. Every other statistic, every other population has decreased other than people getting returned to prison for technical violations. They didn't even commit a new crime. The marginal cost for people getting, that's a year, getting locked up in our New York State prisons is $60,000. That's a marginal cost. We know it goes into the hundreds of thousands. The marginal cost is $60,000 per head. We right now have 4,000 individuals in New York State prisons on a technical violation. That's $240 million minimum that we're paying for people that didn't even commit a new crime. But we're talking about healthcare. We're talking about education. We're talking about people having to go to these food banks and things like that. You know, they're not even getting properly funded, but we have to go to them to supplement what our household. $240 million. Rikers Island is $90,000 and above. December of 2018, they had 680 people on Rikers Island for a technical violation. In January, 27 days later, that number went up 100. Right now, the number is at 800. Every month, it's going up and going up and going up. We think that it would go down with these criminal justice reform bills and with a different mentality. No. Parole will take the hit. So we see also the numbers increasing for people getting locked up for technical violations. People in Albany County, it took me about 5 months to get the stats for Albany. I was really not wanting to give out the stats to members, community members in the Capital District about New York City, about Buffalo and Rochester without having any data about Albany. Finally got the data in Albany. Albany, I think the number is 26% higher than 2016 of people getting returned back to prison. Schenectady is 36% higher since 2016. It tells you right there, in 2016, of the people getting returned to prison for parole violations, technical violations accounted for 6,300 individuals, 65%. They didn't even commit a new crime. So the way they address this is, and New York prides itself on being a just state. New York State incarcerates more people for technical violations than any other state in the country other than Illinois. Isn't that the place where somebody gets shot like every something seconds or something like that, every something minutes or whatever like that? That's the only state that's beating us right now in the country. The only state in the country that's beating us. So we came up with a solution. The solution is less is more New York, less mass supervision equals more public safety. There's no data that you can, and I challenge anybody, there's no data to show that more people on parole decreases public safety. That's a scare tactic. There's no data to show that. However, there is data to show that it's more public safety with less people on mass supervision. We got 4.5 million people in the United States on some type of community supervision. 4.5 million people. In New York State, we have 36,000 individuals. In Albany County alone, we have 36 people a day subject to incarceration for a technical violation. How do we address that?
And that was Willie Terry's report on the recent community dialogue in Albany on parole. Or he's not on parole, but that was the discussion, okay? Okay, now, well, our next segment. Schenectady Today host Ann Perillo speaks with Dr. Valerie Ramson, the chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory, about MI Sykes' upcoming celebration of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 moon landing. So here we go.
Tell me, how are you celebrating this?
Well, we have an exhibit coming out in July and August. There was a local woman whose father was in the Apollo program, and she's gifting us some of her pieces. So we have a lunar module manual. We have lots of letters and signatures of the different astronauts. So those will be on display. And then we're having Lunar Engagement Day on July 20th, where kids and families can come, do lots of hands-on activities, see a couple of documentaries. It's going to be a really fun day.
Any moon rocks?
We weren't able to get the moon rocks. We tried, but I think they're really popular this summer.
I think so
they're touring
yeah.
all over the place.
Actually, just take any rock and say, oh, this is a moon
yeah,
rock.
You know?
No, no, we wouldn't do that. No, not the museum would
right,
never do
right.
that.
Right, right. No, no, never.
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is to celebrate this accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we will now have one in 20 years for Mars?
Yeah, you know, I'm really hopeful that I'll
Mars?
Live through Mars, right? Right. So everything we learned from the moon landing has taught us how to improve the technology and get ourselves to another object in space, and Mars is really next.
What did we learn from the lunar landing? What did we learn? Were there elements there that we had never seen before? Was there an atmosphere that we didn't expect?
Right, right. Well, the first thing we learned is that space is hard, right? It's hard to go to space. You need a lot of technology. The rocketry
oh,
is
gotcha.
Dangerous, you know? So we learned a lot about that.
They did a lot of experimental work
oh, very
on,
much
on
so.
The,
yeah.
With bugs and things like that.
Yeah, they sent a lot of animals up. Both the Soviet Union and the United States sent a ton of animals up before they sent humans.
Sputnik was the first one.
Yeah, Sputnik was the first satellite,
yeah.
and then they sent some dogs after that,
yeah,
and
yeah.
a bunch of monkeys, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
But about the moon specifically, we learned about the interior of the moon. We learned about the dust, which is basically tiny shards of glass all over the moon. Yeah, it's very dangerous,
silica.
That lunar
yeah,
dust.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And if you breathe in too much, you'll get sick. It'll cut up your lungs. So we have to be careful if we send astronauts back to the moon, for sure.
Well, see, but you learned that.
You
right?
did,
They
yes.
didn't expect
you,
that.
We wouldn't have known had a human being not gone to the moon. So it is important not just to send the robotics, but to also send people who are going to interact with the surface of the moon.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And gravitational pull is different
yes,
as well.
Yes, it's a little bit less, so that's why you see the astronauts like jumping
bouncing,
around.
Yeah,
yeah I bet
yeah.
it's a lot of fun up there.
You gonna go?
No. I'm gonna keep my feet on the ground and I'm gonna cheer on everybody else who
I
goes.
I know,
but
it's like you imagine it, and of course I'm one of these people who's I'm a Trekkie, you know, I love Star
mm-hmm.
Trek
oh, me too.
And things like that
me
that
too.
Kind of make you look at the world in a different way that we are mm-hmm. we're here, but there's so much out there. Now
right.
whether there's life out there, we don't know.
Right, right. We don't know yet.
And I think they found a few planets or stars or whatever that could support life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have.
As we know it.
Yes, yes, that is the key. And there's so much more out there. The universe is so big. Like, in my mind, there's got to be something else out there. We just have to find it.
Yeah, yeah. And it eventually, you know, mm-hmm. who knows if we don't blow ourselves up first.
Right, right.
You know, God. But we want to remind people that they can enjoy mm-hmm. the celebration, which is the 16th through the 24th.
Yep.
That's going to be at the Dudley or at my site as well?
Well, it's all one and the same. So
yeah,
the exhibit is going to be up inside the museum, and then July 20th, this Saturday, is the big day with the film screenings and all the hands-on activities, and the telescope will be open as well.
Okay, and planetarium?
Yes, planetarium too.
Yeah, and now you said the film screening. What are you going to be showing?
Yeah, so in the morning, 10:30 in the morning on that Saturday, we're doing Ready, Jet, Go. It's a PBS series, a cartoon
oh, yeah,
for kids.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, all about, they'll do a sleepover on the moon. And then in the afternoon at 4 o'clock, we're going to do a screening of Earthrise, which is really about Apollo 8 and that famous picture of the Earth rising over the moon. So a very
Wasn't
sentimental documentary.
Wasn't that an amazing photo?
Yes.
And it was like that.
Right.
The only time he could have caught it was right there.
Yep, and it puts everything into perspective. Like, everybody you know is on that blue globe.
Rise, yeah.
And you're not. You're standing on the moon
yeah.
or orbiting around
yeah,
the moon.
Yeah, they were orbiting at the time. And it was just a chance. I read about how they took the photo.
Mm-hmm.
It was just chance that
yeah.
that he looked and saw it.
It was like, oh my gosh, we have to take this picture.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, it wasn't, if they'd been sleeping, we never would have
right,
gotten him.
Right,
yeah.
right, exactly.
I mean, amazing. But the idea of celebrating this, and I know people say, well, this is wasted money. It isn't wasted money
mm-hmm.
because it's part of the scientific exploration that we're
right.
doing. And we really need to be aware of what's out there. And the moon is our satellite, you know.
Right, right. Yeah. The moon is right there.
Of course,
there.
If we were in Saturn, we'd have a lot of moons to
that's
go
true,
for, right?
That's true. That's true. Then we'd have rings, too,
we'd
to
have
investigate.
Rings, too. Rings
yeah,
and
it'd
moons.
Be a lot of fun to be on Saturn.
I know. But maybe someday you and I will be sitting here talking about the Mars.
I'm hopeful, yeah.
You ever see the movie The Martian? Wasn't that an
mm-hmm.
interesting film?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah,
yes.
It was really... I can't imagine being alone
somewhere. I know. Someday we'll be up there. It'll be great.
And I hope hopefully there'll be a woman involved in
that
too.
That would be nice. That would be nice.
And we didn't mention the Challenger Learning Center, which we have. You could go to a satellite.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we do mostly school groups now, but yeah, you can bring the whole group of kids and you can do a simulated mission to space, go to the space station and see what it's like to be an astronaut.
How cool is that? We're talking about My Side, the Museum of Innovation and Science right here in Schenectady, and the Dudley Observatory, which is doesn't look like a huge building, but it's perfect.
No,
it's got a wonderful...
Right. The roof rolls off, so it's awesome.
We got to get the roof off. That's the important thing. So thanks so much, Valerie, for being here. It's always a pleasure to have
you
on and chit-chat about space.
Oh,
yeah. You
yes.
know, you and I are, you know, one of these days.
Anytime.
And that was Ann Perillo speaking with Dr. Valerie Rapson, the chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory.
Suffragette Festival last night, and I believe we have a guest appearance here. What was the show like last night?
So I attended Spirit of the Suffragettes last night as a volunteer and an inspired observer. It was absolutely amazing. The acts were phenomenal. They're, you know, just incredible musical talents. It was Girl Blue and Martha Redbone, and they had really different styles and just got the crowd energized in different ways. It was a beautiful afternoon, sunny, and a lot of fun.
And this happens every Tuesday night, right?
Every Tuesday night for 6 full weeks of fun, yeah.
And it's free?
It's totally free, and it's out in the open, and there's free food and community resources. There were lots of groups out last night. Unity House was out, voter organizations, and a group for the arts with RPI. It was excellent.
Was there any dancing?
Oh, definitely a lot of dancing. Yes, the artists were getting everyone dancing.
It sounds like a fantastic evening. So we have to go every Tuesday night at what time is it? 5?
5 to 8 p.m., I believe.
5 to 8?
Correct.
Well, I think that's on my calendar.
Well, speaking of your calendar, so just remember that the Dudley Observatory 50th anniversary celebration of the Apollo 11, which actually did happen, landed on the moon, and it runs from July 16th to 24th with Lunar Engagement Day on July 20th. And you can go to www.misci.org for more information.
Or you can call 518-382-7890. Okay, well, I must say we're concluding the show. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Conliff.
And I'm Mark Dunley. And our engineer tonight was Felix Magai. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all this creative, dedicated to supporting jazz and in the Hudson Mohawk region. And we should say, introduce our guest intern host.
My name is Sharon.
Hi, Sharon. Thanks so much for coming in. But as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers like Shannon. And if you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, please shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or stop by on any of our Monday night meetings at 7:07, held right here at the beautiful studios at Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.